Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Since the 1973 landmark Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion in the United States, state governments have passed 1,193 abortion restrictions, according to the Guttmacher Institute. 29 states are hostile or extremely hostile to abortion rights. Only 12 are supportive. Only 30% of women live in states that are supportive of abortion rights across the country. As politicians have reduced access to reproductive education and care, activists have organized to form a cohesive and intersectional vision for the protection of reproductive rights. Activists are now dealing with the very real prospect of abortion being illegal in many states across the country, which will happen if Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed to the Supreme Court. On Monday, the Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to hold a hearing regarding allegations that Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted and attempted to rape California professor Dr. Christine Blasey Ford when they were in high school. Joining us to talk about the latest is Ricky Solinger, a historian and a curator creating books and exhibitions about reproductive politics, welfare politics, the politics of incarceration, race and class, and motherhood. Ricky Solinger is co-author of many books, including her latest, Reproductive Justice, an Introduction, which she co-wrote with Loretta Ross, co-founder of the women of color-led reproductive justice group, Sister Song. Hi, Ricky. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose.
Well, amazing timing to have you on the show today, Ricky. I mean, what do you think? What are your thoughts about the latest? The details are so graphic. So many women, once again, and some men, are going onto Twitter to talk about how they were either sexually assaulted or raped in high school. And I should have mentioned, I'm sorry, I've been on the air all morning, that this will be triggering for a lot of people.
I guess it will be.
Right.
I think, as Senator Byrd said in 1991, no one has a right to be a Supreme Court justice. And we have to think about not so much the right of this individual person, but the right of the country to have a suspicion-free justice on the Supreme Court. Apparently, there's a lot of feeling that Kavanaugh has fudged or misled or outright lied about other things. One has learned over the course of decades, and certainly it's gotten heightened during the Me Too movement, that women tell the truth about these things. What possible thing could this woman have to gain from putting herself out, telling the truth of something that happened to her when she was 15. So we have lots of evidence and lots of reason to believe that this woman is telling the truth, which suggests, therefore, that Kavanaugh is not telling the truth, apparently not for the first time. So that's what I think about it.
Well, and it is amazing because Dr. Christine Blasey Ford has been doxxed already online, receiving a lot of death threats. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, her address mm-hmm. has been published online, which is what happens to women across the board, women who are op-ed writers, women who speak out. And she decided to come forward, because there were a lot of reporters going to her house trying to figure out who she was, trying to figure out the story. And she said, all right, I'm going to go on the record. I'm going to do this. I mean, she's going to testify on Monday.
Well, it was apparently a process, because
right.
she decided before Kavanaugh was a public figure, so big a public figure, and before he was nominated, that this was something that she had to do. And I read probably either in the Washington Post or New York Times this morning that she was doing this as part of a healing process. And that may or may not be true. Mm-hmm. But I read her action as being part of the responsibility of citizenship, that she felt really violated not only the first time, but also the second time that this man was going to ascend to the highest court in the land, and he had this in his history. And something that we now see, if it is true, and we have lots of reason to think it's true, that he continues to lie about.
You have written extensively about the history of reproductive justice, and we'll talk about that during today's show. But for so many reasons, obvious reasons, a lot of people are bringing up Anita Hill. In fact, on some of the cable shows last night, they played long excerpts of Anita Hill being questioned by Senator Joe Biden. And it was very, very graphic. Anita Hill's parents.
Wasn't it painful
to
watch?
It was so painful to watch. And it reminded me of that amazing documentary about Anita Hill, which everyone should go watch if you haven't seen it already. And the thing that got me is, you know, when her parents walked in the room, she gave her mom a big hug. And she said the one thing that bothered her the most is that she couldn't protect her parents from the graphic details of what happened to her.
Yeah, you know, watching that was horrible, horribly painful and ugly, the ways that not only Biden but others spoke to her. And the question this morning is, will we relive this kind of treatment of Dr. Ford? Will we relive the outcome, the same outcome, that is disbelief, degradation, dismissal, and voting for appointment? Is 2018 the same as 1991? And actually, that's a really interesting bridging question to reproductive politics. You know, can a woman be a full citizen if she's not believed in a public forum? If her history and her expression of her history, her taking control of her past, generates this kind of hate speech and electronic threats and all the kinds of things you outlined before, will that happen again? I mean, this is something we don't know yet, right? It looks like Senator Grassley is committed to continuing to move as quickly as he can. He announced a little while ago that there would only be two people, Dr. Ford and Kavanaugh, at the Monday hearing. He's not permitting the third person in the room to be there. He's not allowing the case to go to the FBI. Will there be wedges? Will the voices of women and the allies of women be more powerful this time? We don't know. And I say it's a bridge question, and I don't know if you mind if I move over into the reproductive politics domain, which is so closely linked to sex, right?
Right.
That another thing that we don't absolutely know, although we have quite a few clues to, is that many politicians and judges and potential Supreme Court justices believe apparently that you can remove, say, abortion rights. You can take them away from women and everything else can go on as it was yesterday in 2018. This seems to me to be a profoundly misguided idea, because of course we know from looking at the past that in the same way that when women can't speak about their own histories in public without being threatened, if women can't control their own bodies and make decisions about their sexual and reproductive behavior, that begins to affect how much education they can get, because of course if you have heterosexual sex, you can get pregnant anytime, and particularly in a culture which is not only removing abortion rights but also is diminishing access to contraception. So not only is your access to education harmed, your access to employment is harmed. We know that before Roe v. Wade, it's no coincidence that women were not hired. I mean, look at what happened to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She couldn't get a job in a good New York law firm because she was a woman. She was perceived as someone who might have a kid at any moment, and all the training and cases she was in the middle of would be void. So, and so education, employment. We know that access to health care is extremely spotty. We also know that all of these policies that govern women's reproductive capacity, their sexuality, and actually I think again there's a bridge back to Anita Hill here, is that this country remains drenched in ideas about racial difference, and that white status depends on the degradation of people of color. The degradation of people of color depends on the ennoblement of white women. I could go on. Mm. Do you want to jump
please,
in, or should
please.
Please
go on. We have time, so please okay. Go on.
Okay, I'm just thinking about how if women no longer can access abortion legally in all of the states and potentially more than the ones you mentioned, or the numbers that you mentioned, and if they cannot get access to contraception, it's going to impact different groups of women differently. We rarely talk about reproductive politics in the public square by putting race at the center of it. But indeed, everything about who is a legitimate reproducer, who is a legitimate mother, according to the laws and policies in the United States, has always had race at the absolute center. So that, I mean, certainly we know that the history of slavery in the United States, that the institution of slavery in the United States required for its to be sustained and to grow on the reproduction of new enslaved people. So that the wombs and the reproductive capacity of women of color, of Africans, was at the mercy, the dignity, the safety of African and then African American women was absolutely at the mercy of the people who believed that they owned these women. At the very same time, in the 19th century, white women and their motherhood and their sexuality, especially women who had resources, financial resources, who were married, who were protected by the resources that their husbands allied them to, were defined as legitimate reproducers. They were producing valuable white citizens for the new nation. And you know, I often have written about 100 years after that period, in the 1960s, when African-American women were defined not as reproducing to boost the profits and the property of whites, but were perceived as producing valueless children who cost white taxpayers money. And they were perceived, African American women were perceived as excessively fecund, excessively reproductive. And there were attempts in every region of the country to punish poor women of color for reproducing. So their children, far from being valuable property, were perceived as burdens on white America. Mm. And at the same time, we see the invention of adoption in which depended on, ironically, the so-called illegitimate reproduction of white babies by white unwed mothers. Those babies were defined as valuable commodities on a newly invented adoption market. So we see in mid-20th century this absolute definition of babies, of women's bodies, according to race. And I just want to give one more example that I've been thinking about and writing about a lot lately, which is women who are immigrants who live on in one of the worst, probably the worst place in the United States that an immigrant woman could live, and that's on the Texas-Mexico border. The state of Texas passed a law that said, unlike almost all other states, which said that after 5 years, an immigrant woman is eligible for Medicare. Texas said anybody who immigrated to the United States after 1996 is forever ineligible for Medicaid. Mm. Did I say Medicaid the first time? I meant to. Compounding the fact that these immigrant women cannot get, I mean, to say nothing of abortion services, contraceptive services, pap smears, breast exams, you know, all the kinds of things that are crucial to reproductive health and heterosexual experiences with safety and dignity. So not only do we have this rule about Medicaid, but we also have Texas passing rules that say things like, okay, if you can't manage your fertility because you no longer have access to health care, you should get sterilized. So a woman might get sterilized, but then she's not eligible for pap smears and breast exams and other such medical tests because those are only for low cost access to these procedures because those are only available to fertile women. I mean, that's just such a profound example of a catch-22.
You know, Ricky, as you're saying this, the Latina Institute put out some information about what immigrant women are facing. And they write that for more than 40 years, the Hyde Amendment has prevented women on Medicaid from using federally funded insurance to pay for abortions, except in cases of rape, incest, or danger to the mother's life. The same type of language exists in regulation for all facets of the federal government, including ICE. And like Hyde's exemption, ICE will pay for an abortion in cases of rape, incest, or danger to the mother's life, according to the agency's medical records on its website. But according to a Fusion report based on interviews with the director of migrant shelters, it's estimated that 80% of women and girls coming to the U.S. through Central America are sexually assaulted on their journeys.
Which gives rise to lots of pregnancies.
Exactly.
And as we saw in the recent case that Judge Kavanaugh adjudicated, he was dead set against allowing a 15-year-old girl to get an abortion, even though a judge had cleared her for one. So, yes, vulnerability according to race, according to class, according to geography. I mean, that's one of the extraordinary things about reproductive laws and policies in the United States is that it depends not only on who you are and how much money you have, but also where you live. Of course, if you have enough money, you can always go someplace else to get the services that you need. But, you know, one of the sort of most extraordinary innovations of the reproductive justice movement and framework has put forward over the last really 20 years, although it's gained a lot of visibility in the larger community in the last maybe 5 years, But one of the most important developments is perspectives is one that says abortion services are very important, and we have seen how important they are. We've seen how important abortion, legal abortion, has been to women's ability to, as I said, get education, get achieve economic security. But abortion isn't the full ball of wax. We, for example, what we're just talking about now, the Hyde Amendment makes perfectly clear the limits of Roe v. Wade. The Hyde Amendment says if you don't have enough money to buy an abortion as a consumer, that's your tough luck. It's not a right. It's a consumer. It's not a human right. Mm-hmm. It's a consumer's right if you can afford to buy it, if you can afford to pay for it. So even in this era where abortion has been legal now for more than 40 years, it's not enough. And the reason it's not enough is because people who reproduce need far more than legal abortion. Abortion is the right, is part of the right not to reproduce when you don't want to, when you can't afford it, when you're not well enough to do it, when you don't want a child, when you, it will disrupt your career, when it will make you lose your income. So abortion is important, but there are so many other features of life, lived experience, as the reproductive justice movement says, that must be in place for people to be able to reproduce, and I keep using this term, dignity and safety. Mm. And we think about things like living in a safe environment without toxicity in the immediate environment, which will be transferred to your fetus. Being able to raise your children in a neighborhood which is safe and has decent schools. Having access for yourself and your children to decent, high-quality health care. It goes on and on. And, you know, this term, which has become very, very prevalent in discussions of reproductive politics these days, intersectionality. That is, there is no single condition that will provide reproductive safety and dignity to any given woman. The community, the neighborhood she lives in, and the resources they have there for her to be able to access what she needs is crucial. You can only have as many rights as you can access, mm-hmm. as the Hyde Amendment makes very clear. But if you live, as I said, in a geographical area that doesn't have access to birth control or abortion services, or where you cannot get the imaging services that you require, how can we talk about choice? You know, the enslaved woman had no choice. The white woman who was pressed to give up her baby for adoption because she had no husband had no choice. All the authorities in her community said she had to. The ability to make genuine, authentic determinations about how your own life is going to proceed requires more, far more, than access to abortion. I mean, I think we can say it's a classic example of abortion is a necessary but far from sufficient condition.
Today we're speaking with Ricky Solinger, an historian who studies the history of reproductive rights in the United States. She's co-author of the new book, Reproductive Justice, An Introduction, which she co-wrote with Loretta Ross, co-founder of the Women of Color-led Reproductive Justice Group, Sister Song. And Loretta was going to join us. Unfortunately, she is in North Carolina, and she was only able to get one flight out of there because of the horrific flooding and the storms that we are seeing. So Loretta wasn't able to join us. us, but we're so glad that Ricky is here, especially right now, just days before the Senate Judiciary Committee holds a hearing regarding allegations that Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted and attempted to rape California professor Dr. Christine Blasey Ford when they were in high school. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Ricky Solinger, an historian who studies the history of reproductive rights in the United States. She is the author of many books. She's the co-author of Reproductive Justice, An Introduction. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions for Ricky about the really important work she does looking at the racist history of reproductive rights. I mean, this is the kind of information that's so important. We're talking now about what has changed between the time when Anita Hill testified in 1991 to today. Well, what has really changed since the time of massive racism? Ricky was talking about Black women. We're also going to talk about Native women in just a couple of minutes. But what has changed since then? If you, and I know so many of you, have been involved in the reproductive justice movement for decades, really fighting for the right to access abortion, for birth control, for sex education, what are your thoughts about where we are today? I mean, it's 2018. And if Brett Kavanaugh, or let's say his nomination goes away, if the White House decides to terminate that nomination, they're going to appoint someone just as conservative who will have very similar views on abortion. 2018, the prospect of abortion being illegal in many states across the country. How did this happen? How did we get here? What should the response be? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Ricky, what about that very simple question? I always ask guests, how did this happen? And the simple answer is that control over women's bodies, conservative men, anti-choice. It's not just men. There are a lot of anti-choice women, so many more right now. And Joe just wrote an email saying, it seems to me that from the conservative religious perspective, whether women say yes to sex or no to sex, they're always doing it wrong. The common thread through every policy aspect of these issues is that male policymakers cannot wrap their brains around the possibility of female sexual autonomy, or worse, they're terrified by the idea. What are your thoughts, Ricky?
I think that's well put, well and depressingly put. I also want to say that if Loretta were here, I think she'd make lots of brilliant points. But one thing she would say is that over the last year, as Trump has been president, as it's been clear that he's going to restructure the courts and put as many conservatives and continue the war on women through the courts, that Loretta would say she's a real organizer. And to be a real rock-solid organizer, you have to be an optimist. You have to believe that your work is an arc and it's going somewhere and it's reaching and it's worthwhile. And she would say that she has never seen in all the years of her organizing more energy, more focus, more determination out there to fight this development, this series of developments. So I want to say that because I always get so consoled myself and energized to hear the way she puts that with such fervor and determination and conviction. But I also want to say that this question you asked about how did we get here, it's been, you know, a 40-year slog for the people who want to overturn Roe v. Wade. We didn't get here with Brett Kavanaugh or Neil Gorsuch. We didn't get here with Trump. People have been working toward this moment for many decades, and they've worked toward it in lots of different ways. Some of the ways were violent. Some of the ways were murderous. Some of the ways were legislative, and some of them were judicial, and there are lots of other strategies in between. So I think it's been, and also I think it's really important to say that many there are many different kinds of groups that have been working toward this moment, and they have quite different agendas. So there are obviously people who believe that there should not be separation between church and state, and therefore there should not be. It's quite all right to pass laws which have a religious basis, and to impose that on all persons, whether or not they believe in your religious principles. Then, of course, there are people who feel exactly the way that you introduced this question, that, and also the way the emailer described it. That is a horror at the idea that women should possess sexual autonomy, reproductive autonomy, that this destroys traditional structures in society, and it's unbearable for men. And then there are many, many other positions which are represented in this very long struggle to overturn Roe v. Wade.
You know, at a time when so many polls, from the Wall Street Journal to the Pew Research, 70% of the population does not want Roe overturned. 70%. And we talk about this on the show a lot. The media say it's the most divisive issue of our time, even though 70% don't want it overturned. And in the epilogue of your book, women from around the country write reflections on the reproductive justice work that they're doing, ranging from organizing Latina women to oppose the personhood law in Colorado. And that reminds me of the fact that when you take these extreme laws to the people, almost 99% of the time they vote no. We just get these laws from these extreme politicians. So again, I mean, how do you think these groups were able to amass so much power when 70% of the population does not want Roe overturned?
Well, it may be, and I haven't followed this scientifically, but it may be that this is a peak moment, and that the numbers have been, you know, sort of moving over time. And right now, you know, it's reflecting Loretta's position. She has never seen, and many people have never seen, so much expression of support for women's reproductive rights. And as, I mean, what is, are we led to think that it takes this kind of endangerment to make people stand up and speak and vote yes? We want these laws to stay in place. So, I mean, your question, how is it possible for these two such divergent positions to exist simultaneously? Well, one reason you can look, I mean, look at the judiciary, look at the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee, all male. And, you know, if you look at the statistics of who voted for, you know, how white women voted in the presidential election, you know, overwhelmingly for Republicans and for Trump.
Yeah.
So that's...
We just got an email from Greg who says, who will be in the room when Ford and Kavanaugh testify? They're scheduled to testify on Monday, and there are 5, 10, 15, 19 members on the Judiciary Committee. On the Republican side, all men.
Zero.
And then on the Democratic side, there are three women.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. So, you know, I often think, what will it ultimately take? I'm talking about a 40-year struggle to overturn Roe, but how long is the struggle for achieving full citizenship status for women, full personhood dignity for women? How long will that struggle be? I mean, it's a struggle that's been going on in the courts for more than 150 years. And it's a struggle that has had some high points and some periods of quiescence. And, you know, I think these things, I'm a historian. I can't predict the future. But I do believe that this is a long, long, difficult struggle because men do not want to give up male supremacy. I mean, one sees that in one's own life with the men one knows well. You know, it's even men who are enlightened and who try and who are well educated, and men who have achieved various things in their lives that they wanted and believe in the women they know, still have a very, very hard time relinquishing male supremacy. And traditionally, we've elected men. So that's a very important answer, part of the answer of to your question. How can we have such a fervent expression of support from so many people in America to sustain Roe at the same time the politicians, mostly men, are willing to trade it away to, I guess what should happen next is many of these people won't get reelected. What do you think about that? I don't see it.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're seeing a lot of victories that a lot of people did not anticipate, and so many women running for office.
That's true.
Today we're speaking with Rikki Solinger, an historian who studies the history of reproductive rights. She's the author of many books. She co-wrote Reproductive Justice, an Introduction, with Loretta Ross, co-founder of the reproductive justice group Sister Song. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My question was... I want to know if it is all possible to go back and reinvestigate Clarence Thomas for sexual abusement. Abusement, is that a word?
Harassment, I think, was the term.
I mean, he really wasn't investigated the first time, and Anita Hill was definitely telling the truth, and they never even talked to the three other women who accused him. I think that, you know, as a country, we really need to do this, and we need to impeach him.
Well, the thing is that the statute of limitations has run out on something like that. But I think this event and the way that it was handled in 1991 has to be used with vigor and visibility throughout the next couple of days, and however long this can go, this has to be front and center. That the way this was handled the last time, and a refusal to repeat it this time, don't you think?
Well, and since you write so much about race and class, Rikki, race played a major role in that
sure
hearing
did.
Because Clarence Thomas called it a high-tech lynching, and here he was testifying in front of white senators.
Right. Yes. He was very skillful at that. And of course, Arlen Specter, the then Republican senator from Pennsylvania, could say with apparent impunity that Anita Hill was a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty. And because she was an African American woman with, of course, as we see, on Rachel last night and many other places, she was and is a person of profound dignity. And yet he could say this. In part, one can't dismiss because she was an African-American woman. But are we going to have another high-tech lynching of Dr. Ford? Is that what we can expect on Monday? Orrin Hatch seems to be ready to say, I don't believe her. So gender remains a condition of enormous vulnerability.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Nancy. And over the weekend, it's a great time to watch that documentary, Anita, because it'll bring you back to that time. And it does an amazing job of showing the politics, the questions asked. I mean, this is incredible also, Rikki. I think Anita Hill was about 35 when she testified.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly, but it sounds right.
It's just incredible because, I mean, as you said, they tried to get her and she would not allow them to do that. I mean, and the detail that she had to, it was almost like you watched it and you were kind of like putting your hand over your face because it was so graphic and so detailed. And this woman, yes, like so many women, have to live this over and over again.
Right. I mean, I think we will know a lot more about where this country stands a week from today. I think it's an incredibly crucial week. You know, one of the things that you sort of alluded to but is of massive importance is that if one of the scenarios plays out, and there's several possible ones whereby Kavanaugh is no longer the nominee,
right,
then it's unknown what will happen, because for a new nominee to be named, the period of time required to do investigation of that person, to have that person do their social visits with the entire Senate group of senators, to all of that process takes at least 6 weeks, 7 weeks. It's been about 7 weeks since the nomination of Kavanaugh, something like that. Well, that takes us right up to the lip of the election. And here we have we have Mitch McConnell, who, I mean, there's some potential for the most extraordinary payback here, right? If, in fact, McConnell, who refused to give Garland a hearing after Obama nominated him for the Senate, saying that there's an election coming up and we must give the voters their voice. And then McConnell, who is managing this whole procedure, he's really a snake. So there's no guarantee whatsoever. In fact, I think it was a guarantee that he will not be consistent. But I think it's very likely that if Kavanaugh has to step aside, we are going to get into the most extraordinary fight about whether the Republicans have the right to put a new nominee forward.
Wow. We have another question about Kavanaugh. Let's go to Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Doesn't this ratchet up the pressure to release all those documents that are being withheld? This goes to character, and what's a better indication of character than a lawyer's writings? In the case of Sotomayor, she had to release 99% of hers. Here we have I hope this causes something to happen with the documents. It's crazy to keep them out at this point.
Well,
actually, these are documents that track his work in the Bush White House. And I think it was Elena Kagan whose documents were almost entirely released, and she was working in the which White House was she working in? I can't remember. I don't think it was the Obama one. Maybe it was. I think she was the dean
Clinton
of Harvard Law School.
Clinton White House.
I thought it was Clinton. Yeah, because after that she went to be dean at Harvard. But I think the caller is correct that this is another piece of the corrupt politics that is dogging this process, that the Republicans have really undermined the possibility for a real, authentic process that has integrity at its heart, and it has which has a purpose at its heart of naming a noble person to be part of the Supreme Court.
Well, thank you, Ken. And again, to your point, they have about 10% of the documents. They want the other 90. I mean, what a massive
That's
number.
Right.
And
right.
I was just reading, Ricky, that a group of senators, including Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, filed a lawsuit on Monday against the National Archives to gain access to those records. So they're still trying.
Yeah, they're still trying. That's why I say that the next week, we will know so much more over the next week about how much integrity is demanded and how much integrity will be delivered and where we are politically in terms of sexuality and gender and power in this country.
Let's go next, and we're almost out of time. This just flew by. Let's hear from Dr. Suzanne Pullen. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me on. This conversation is so important. A lot of the work that I've done in regards to, in relationship to reproductive justice, is involved incorporating the conversation of stillbirth and miscarriage. I've advocated in Washington to try and pass legislation for stillbirth prevention and research funding, and I'll get conversations on the Democratic side of the aisle that we don't want to talk about it because it feels too much like our constituents might think this is a pro-life argument, versus the Republicans who say we don't want to spend any money on appropriations. And it's such a divisive conversation, and so reproductive justice allows us to restore both those families who desperately want healthy babies, and to recognize that the laws that we pass to try and prevent abortion or contraception use impacts those families who are also desperate to have children as well.
Yeah, thank you. That's very important. And I really appreciate what you say about how anti-abortion people can try to co-opt this these sets of claims in a way that's extremely destructive. And actually, you've reminded me of something that I didn't say and really want to get in before we finish here. And that is what really makes reproductive—I sort of alluded to it, but I want to say it very clearly, that what really makes reproductive justice different from the old pro-choice, anti-abortion debate is that it makes three very powerful claims. It says that people have to be able to have the right to have children, not to have children, not to have children when they don't want them. They have to have the right to to have children and to not have children. Those are the two claims. And that those are the two of the central claims. And the third is to be able to raise your children in safe and healthy environments. But this issue that you have to have the right to be able to have children was previously left out of reproductive politics and has had such a huge impact on the possibilities for poor women, for women of color, for women who are disabled, for many populations of people who want to have children and who were stigmatized and punished for having children in various ways. So this is a key component of reproductive justice.
Mm. Well, Ricky, thank you. This hour just went by so fast, and I'd love to have you back maybe right after the hearings, because as you said, so much, it's going to be very telling to see what happens this week and on Monday. Ricky Solinger is an historian who studies the history of reproductive rights in the U.S., and she's co-author of the book Reproductive Justice, an Introduction. Ricky, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Bye.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.